Distributing the Future broadcast April 24, 2006, Women in Open Source and Emergent Gaming Behavior.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. How do you go about attracting more women to write open source code? Denise Cooper has been looking at different models that work and is trying to spread the word. We also continue our conversation with Jane McGonigal about super gaming. This week she talks about the community that surrounds some of her games and some of the emerging patterns that she's noted. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Host your next meeting online with GoToMeeting. Everyone logs on to your meeting during your conference call, so they see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's like meeting in person, but less expensive and time-consuming. With GoToMeeting, you can demo products, present, or train just like you're in the same room. GoToMeeting has a low, flat monthly rate, so meet as often as you want for as long as you need. Try it free today at gotomeeting.com/DTF. That's gotomeeting.com/DTF. Suppose you wanted to write code for free to help out your favorite open source project. Shouldn't they be delighted to have you? If you look at it from their perspective, they need to know a little bit more about you. They want you to demonstrate that the code you write is robust and maybe even that you can get along with other members of the community. What attracts you to a community where you work for free and still have to prove yourself? Well, maybe you look for other people like you, people you've met at conferences or people whose books you've read or whose code you've run. For underrepresented groups, this can be a problem. If there aren't that many women on the team, how do you attract new women? Should the open source developer community be more reflective of the composition of the end users for the software they're creating? More women? More people from outside of North America? Denise Cooper and others have been thinking a lot about this issue, and specifically about women in open source. And she's found some promising models in the Debian community that she's hoping can be replicated elsewhere. We talked to Denise last fall, and she reported,
I went to the Debian conference in Europe this year in Helsinki. It was the first time that I'd had any dealings with the Debian community because my previous job didn't really touch Debian much. And I'd been looking forward to spending some time with them because they're just, you know, sort of famously social, famously, it's not just a project, it's a tribe. And I found that interesting. So I went, and one of the things that they're doing, they've been doing for about the last year, is this Debian Women project. And if I understand correctly, Debian Women was started by women who found themselves hanging around at Debian, you know, because they were involved with people who were hanging around or through personal interest, but they were having trouble finding a way to sort of feel like they were in the community or to own it, if you know what I'm saying. And in my day job, I'm trying to convince the emerging world that participation is ownership in open source. So this is really interesting to me that here's a group of women that they're European and North American women, but they wanted some ownership and yet couldn't find a way in. And so they decided to band together and try to help each other and actually promote and mentor themselves in to Debian as peers. I was really turned on to the way that they took charge of their issue and decided to work together as peers to try to see how many women they could promote. And in the process, they came across a lot of issues that actually are issues for all newbies coming into open source projects, or specifically to Debian. And so they created resources that were reusable for a large variety of cases of people just coming into the community. There's a couple of interesting things happening. They have a troll problem. That's where people come and say nasty things that are frankly unwelcome within the community. And women are used to this. This happens all the time. It's just a fact of life. It's an unfortunate fact of life for women. But these guys that are part of the Debian Women Project had never actually seen it before, and they're horrified, and they want to fix it. And the women are like, you know, usually if you ignore them, they go away. And the guys are like, no, this is not okay. And I'd say they're average men. They're not particularly feminist. They're interested in this technology. They're interested in free software and seeing Debian be a good place to hang out, because the definition of a Debian developer is fairly well thought out already by the Debian community. They actively mentored women through the process of becoming Debian developers. And this all looked pretty interesting to me. It's not a perfect list, but it, you know, it was women taking action. I thought that was really interesting. The next week, I found myself in Stuttgart, Germany at ApacheCon, where I was giving a keynote about open source in the developing world. And I gave my talk at Wilfredo Sanchez's request called Lightning Talk on women in open source. He picked that talk because he knew that I had a panel coming up at OSCON. At the end of the Lightning Talk, about a third of the conference attendees came up to me. So it may be the most fruitful talk I've ever given, because it had a huge impact. People directly came up to me and wanted to talk about what was brought up for them. Some people were really angry and felt like I was misrepresenting a problem. Some people really thought it was right on, and some people thought I hadn't gone far enough. And one of the women that was at the conference, who works for IBM, she's assigned to work on Apache right now. She had previously worked on GNOME, which is another open source project, assigned to work on that project, and discovered that she didn't want to stick around when she was done with that assignment because she found that community to be too abrasive. But she was enjoying her work at Apache, and she wanted to make Apache a better place. She told me a story about coworkers she had who were not fitting in as well as she was doing into the Apache framework. Other women who were assigned to work on the same project she was working on and were saying, you know, I can't wait until this is over. I'm really not enjoying this. And she wanted to change that. So there's a good example of a way to explain it to people. You know, a concrete example of someone who maybe had tried to post or had felt rebuffed in their day-to-day work and thought, God, I just can't wait until I don't have to deal with these people anymore. That's surprising when you tell someone at a project like Apache, which is actually a pretty moderate open source place, or at least it's known for that. You know, your average Apache member will say, wow, that's not how we want people to feel. Now, some of them will say, if they can't take it, they shouldn't be here. But, you know, there is a large percentage of people in open source who wonder why more women aren't sort of, you know, running the gauntlet and finding themselves, you know, in the game. And just looking at that, what we're trying to do now is collect stories from women who have made it into open source about where they felt rebuffed, what they had to do differently, how they had to, you know, how they found their way. And we're also going to try to start having conversations with people who are trying to get in real time, finding out where they feel rebuffed. There are a lot of practices that the Debian women have identified and modified on their list. They're not trying to change Debian. They're just trying to create a portal and then help people understand how to swim in the mainstream of Debian. And so here an example would be, it's typical when you subscribe in an open source project to a mail list that you can be anonymous for some period of time. And the expectation is you'll either go away quietly or at some point you'll de-lurk, explain who you are, and that's the first step in building acceptance. But if you think about how people actually live in the world, what happens if you walk into somebody else's living room is, you know, they say, who are you? And you have a conversation right away about who you are that is the beginning of feeling comfortable. And so the Debian women started welcoming each new subscriber, saying, you know, so-and-so has just subscribed. And there would be some welcoming, both public welcoming and then a back channel message directly to that person from one or more members saying, is there any way that we can help you? What's your interest? Sort of drawing them out as you would in a social situation, on the theory that some of the problem that newbies have is understanding this new cotillion, if you will, of the way that people interact in open source projects. If it felt more like a normal interaction, then we could help them understand, well, when you go to your next list, you may have to explain yourself a little bit, and here's how you might choose to do that. So trying to get in earlier and being a little more welcoming. is an example of something that they would do. I don't think anybody's suggesting that anyone should get a special ride or different ride. This is not an affirmative action thing. This isn't let's take people who are less qualified and somehow make them qualified. We're working on the assumption that these people have value to bring to the community, but that that not everyone is going to automatically be willing to run the gauntlet, and some people may need a little more help to understand what the rules are. I happen to be a person who really likes working my way into societies. It's fun for me. It's not necessarily fun for everybody to do that. And yet, if you believe that this is a better way to make software happen, which I happen to believe, then you got to want, you know, more people to be involved. My general work is to try to involve more people. I'm interested in how people from different cultures might find their way in as well. When I go to India and China, I get a lot of questions about how can I participate? How can I find my way in to this Western community where I don't, in a cultural way, don't always understand where they're coming from? And I think some of the cases play out the same. As we explained when we proposed the Women's List at Apache, it's not so much that we want to focus only on women, and certainly we want men involved in every step of trying to sort this problem out. But we do want to focus on a part of the larger problem, because a lot of what we learn is going to be applicable across all newbie parts of the community. I want open source, the whole ecosystem of open source, to more truly mirror the way that the rest of the world is, right? The fact is, there are actually more women in the world than men, and that implies that there are going to be more end users of technology someday who are women than men. And I want to see software for people, not so much, you know, Tim always talks about the Uber geeks. I love the Uber geeks. I'm married to one of them. But I want to see the end result of the downstream effect of all this work that they're doing benefit the largest number of people. And I think having more women involved in the creation of this can only help create work that's more useful, more generally useful.
Denise Cooper of Intel. She's been talking about women in open source at OSCON and ApacheCon. Last week, you heard Jane McGonigal explain about super gaming, taking small, intimate games and scaling them up so that 1,000 people can play them. This time, she talks about some of the emergent behavior that arises in these games and some of the bigger issues that parallel online communities. She's watched communities deal effectively with newbies and with members who weren't behaving in the spirit of the game, even though they insisted they were behaving according to the strict letter of the laws. She explains that some emergent behavior interests her more than other types.
There's sort of two kinds of emergence that we can talk about. One is when you get a lot of individual, you know, bits of data or living creatures all doing something so that at a high level they become some sort of, you know, single organism or the hive mind, that sort of thing. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested more in the model of collective intelligence where there's much more diversity in terms of what's being done and distributed skill sets, distributed decision making, and the kind of emergence that occurs is more akin to, you know, when physics talk about emergence, that term was first introduced simply to say that at higher levels, there's more complexity and surprising things that happen, and that by looking at the micro level, you simply can't predict what will happen at the macro level. So the kind of emergence that I'm interested in exploring through these super games is to get enough people doing something and to iterate it enough times that we learn about, you know, we see patterns and we see people making connections with other people or specific places, getting these sort of layers of gaming laid on top of them over time and changing that space. But it's not about creating a mob or creating a hive mind. It's more about letting interesting patterns and connections emerge that we can look at and say, why is it that bookstores are a highly uncomfortable place for many people to play. It's easier for people to go play in someone else's church, for instance, in games that I've designed, than it is for people to go into a bookstore to play. And what is the sort of structure in that social space that people buy into that makes them feel like they can't intervene or be any kind of disruption versus games where we've sent players into churches to sit in a pew and find, you know, look through the materials and, you know, might be and where people are there doing their daily worship and no problem, say the vast majority of players. Ask them to go into a secular public space and you start to see all these patterns of guilt and resistance. And so that's the sort of thing that, you know, that the sort of scale of enough people doing it and iterating it that you can get very non-intuitive findings that, you know, and are significant in a sort of, I guess, scientific research way. One of the goals of these games is to make the community entirely responsible for enforcing the rule set and for enforcing the spirit of the game. You know, we call designers of these games puppet masters, but puppet masters rarely intervene or rarely do any top-down management of the game once it's in play, unless, you know, I'm sure we would if there was a serious, you know, some kind of safety risk or something. But what we like to see is the communities making decisions and coming up with procedures for finding out who is being a disruptive force, for figuring out what level of retribution they want to visit on that person. So for instance, in the Isle of Bees game, one of the things I was doing on the game was I was blogging as a fictional character to summarize things that had happened in the game so far. And one of the players sort of accidentally social engineered the blogging service to change the official email address of record to this player's instead of the character's. And that meant that player could now request the password and be the blogger and change all the blogging and take over. The player hadn't expected to be successful, went away camping for the weekend, didn't even realize what he had done. Meanwhile, the players discovered the hack even before I did or any of the other puppet masters. And the way it came to my attention was by stumbling across forums and IRC channels of people debating what to do with this kid once he got back from camping. And they worked out what they thought would be a fair, you know, enforcement, you know, or payback, but, you know, keep him in the game. And they made up a whole list of, okay, this is in game, this is out of game, this is fair game. You know, nowhere in these games does it say you can't hack a, you know, a character's blog. I mean, why not? We weren't mad. We thought it was, you know, cool. We had to get the blog back. You know, the community handled it. We didn't have to contact this kid. We didn't have to say, don't hack our stuff anymore. So absolutely to see the community's, you know, structure and do it efficiently and fairly. You know, I've talked to lots of different kinds of organizations about these games. And the thing that is of interest to many of, you know, educational groups and not-for-profit groups, foundations, is why are these gamers so effective at coming up with very equitable solutions and, managing themselves in this very emergent way? And how could we apply that? And that just gets back to why I like to do gaming projects rather than, you know, what you might call traditional performance, because I do believe that the structure of games allows that kind of the clarity of a game structure allows that sort of emergent community organization. Many of these games, you just sort of fall into without really understanding the scope of it or what will be asked of you. So it does tend to attract people, a great range of people. They are, I think, changed by the experience. I mean, I see these games as a sort of learning culture not necessarily that we're designing something to teach to the players, but rather that the community creates its own learning culture and teaches other players how to play. You do see people coming in with crazy expectations of what a game is, and all's fair, and it's not being a spoil sport if you play by the letter of the rules, but it's not really the spirit. They are definitely schooled, and I think what is fortunate for these kinds of games is that much like with the web, when we saw forum leaders come and set, enjoy the sort of responsibility of shepherding people and getting a real degree. These games facilitate that same process. And you see a lot of people who used to be like sysops for bulletin boards in the early days are the same people who are being moderators in this gaming community, because it is an opportunity to shepherd and support.
Jane McGonigal on the communities and emergent behavior that surrounds super games. Thanks also to Denise Cooper. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Online meetings made easy. Try it free at GoToMeeting.com/DTF. Thanks to all of you who emailed in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.